Hello, and welcome back to another edition of Inside Network Marketing. This is your host, Len Clements, and I'm the founder and CEO of MarketWaves. If you're listening to the show for the first time, please check out everything that I do over at MarketWaveInc.com. And this is actually show number 15. This is the first show that I've done in eight months. It's been about 8 months because I've actually been a little busy. My intent was to go out and build a downline, actually get back in the trenches with the rest of you and get out there and create some of that residual income that I lived off of quite well between about 1995 and 2003. And that allowed me to kind of do a lot of these types of projects where, you know, we're working on the industry and for the industry, writing articles, doing a lot of live training, things like that. But then I kind of was forced around 2004 to find a little bit different way to make a living at this for a while. So I went into corporate, tried to start my own company. Most recently, I've been working a lot on consulting, expert witness jobs and things like that. So that's, and those, of course, take priority. So that's where I've been for about the last 8 months. I do intend to do a lot more of these here coming up and start getting back into writing articles and things like that. But right now, you know, I got to go after the now money. And when someone says, here's $225 an hour to design our comp plan, that's tough to turn down. I keep saying, this is the last one. After this one, I'm going back in. I'm going to go build a downline and get back into the business here. And then someone comes along and says, well, here, now here's $225 an hour to represent us in a wrongful termination case or something. And yeah, it's just like, I got to take that because it's pretty good money. And it's actually, I enjoy it. It's fun. But the challenge that I've had is that the last three expert witness gigs that I've had, two of them ended up settling before they even got to me, which is actually quite common in this business. And the other one involved a wrongful termination case that I was asked to represent the allegedly wrongfully terminated distributor. And I'm trying to not even use pronouns here or anything because I don't want to give any of this away. It's all quite confidential. But let's just say the person I was asked to represent and I didn't exactly have the most amicable relationship. The last three consulting jobs that I've been offered, I talked them all out of it. So it's hard to make a living doing that. I take companies through what I call a devil's advocacy phase. And I do that because I've found that there's a lot of situations where I've had consulting clients, people starting up companies, and they've come to me after they've already spoken to another consultant who gave them a bid on how to design their comp plan or whatever they're going to do to help them start the company. And this concept has no possible way of working. Now understand, I keep the bar pretty low. If there is a way to make it work, I'll find a way to make it work. But some of these people, for example, I had someone come to me once where they owned a single location, family-owned furniture store in downtown Fresno, California. And they wanted to network market their furniture. And they, by the way, they'd already gotten a bid from another fairly well-known consultant about how to help them start that company. And I said, you know what, pay me $225 an hour, probably for a half hour prorated, and I'll explain to you why this can't possibly work. And that's exactly what we did. There was another one just a few years ago. This woman came to me with this great concept for a network marketing company and said she'd already raised the money for it. She already got a couple other bids from a couple other consultants, which she didn't name, but what she was going to sell was a rubber shoe insole with strategically placed bumps on it that massaged the bottom of your foot in certain ways where it cured these various diseases. All the medical claims and FDA issues aside, the shoe insole cost $3 retail, and it would last about 90 days. So think of the economics of that. Selling a product that will last 90 days, you order it about four times a year, and it's only going to cost $3. So it's, that's not going to work. So anyway, if I keep talking consulting clients out of it, I got to find another way to make a living here. So yeah, getting back into the trenches. By the way, and again, because of confidentiality issues, I don't want to give any other clues here, but one of my recent consulting clients actually was the subject of the television show Undercover Boss. He was the undercover boss on a show a few weeks ago. If anyone's fans of that show, kind of think back of all the different companies that were represented there and imagine, which ones really wouldn't fit with the network marketing model, and you can get an idea there. But yeah, this one didn't really work, so kind of talked him out of it. But we're back in the business here. Going to start writing more articles, doing these podcasts, doing some generic training and things like that. I'll still always do that, but building the business in the meantime. Please also hold the pitches. All right, that's already taken care of. I'm not looking. One of the things I want to mention before we kind of get into the details here about kind of what's going on with Agile and some of the soap opera and the drama going on with them, as well as Eero Research, just recently went out of business. There's also a doghouse column I've got coming up. The doghouse used to be part of my old newsletter, and I'd get a different occupant of the doghouse every issue. We'll start doing that here with this show, and you'll kind of enjoy the one that's in this one. And every show, I want to kind of do a quick review of a particular opportunity that's out there right now. And the one, it's not necessarily the hottest, but a one that I think definitely is a good educational process of kind of what to look for and what to watch out for and things like that. It's a company called IV7. And we'll get into that here in a minute as well, too. But I've been working on a project for, originally it was called the anti-MLMzealot.com website. Don't go there. It's not functional yet. But that was an idea I had where I was going to try to make a really formal response to all the anti-MLM zealots propaganda out there. There's only about half a dozen of them, but they're prolific. I mean, they just produce tons of stuff. If you do a Google search of MLM, typically 3, 4, sometimes 5 of the top 10 hits are anti-MLM sites. And someone had to kind of do a response to all of that, put the call out. I wrote a letter, which, by the way, if anyone wants me to send them a copy of this letter where I kind of made the case for why a site like this was needed, just let me know and I can email it to you. But it's something where I wanted to put the call out, say, like, can we get a group of leaders together and kind of fund this thing and bring some technology together and some video production together and whatever and create a response to all of that. And I got the same response that I got pretty much for the last 20 years, which is, well, if we give them more attention, then it will give them more credibility. It'll draw more people to them that otherwise might not have known about them. Of course, my argument is that made sense before this thing called the Internet. So now if we give them more attention by responding to their claims and all of the garbage they say about us, which is easily refutable, you know, then maybe, yeah, 97% of our prospects might be aware of them instead of 95. So, I mean, anybody out there that's doing their due diligence or doing any kind of investigation into this industry, like as little as going online and just Googling their company or the industry a little bit, they're going to see all of this stuff. So why do we keep just burying our head in the sand and ignoring it and letting them battle away at us unimpeded? And that's pretty much what's been going on. I kind of liken it to the current day U.S. Marines fighting the Cro-Magnon man from back in the caveman days. And the reason why we can't win that war is because the Marines are putting their hands behind their back and closing their eyes and jutting their chins out and saying, throw all the rocks and spears at us you want, we're just going to stand here and take it. And we could end this in a heartbeat by simply acknowledging all of their crap and responding to it. Because some of this stuff, like you can have a better chance of making money in Vegas at the craps table, or only the people at the top that get in early make all the money, or we're all going to saturate the earth, every company's doomed to fail, and all of this stuff is so easily refutable with logical, verifiable, legal, mathematical facts. But, oh, we don't want to do that because it lends more credibility to the attackers. It gives them more attention. We sink to their level. I've heard all these different things. So I got to go where the support is. And so I got some pretty good people together, a lot of talent in this industry and a lot of leadership. And they said, you know, let's go in a little bit different direction, though, and just create more of a pro-MLM site that really supports the industry. But really the really definitive site that has, I mean, this has been done to some extent already online, but like the much, much more elaborate, much more high production values, things like that, and really create a great case for network marketing and why it's legitimate. You know, we will respond to all of those questions, but more kind of generically, not pointing fingers at any particular person. You know, so like if the media or a government agency or whatever, if they want to know where to go to get the facts, this is the website they're going to go to, as well as your prospects, of course. If you ever have a prospect, we've all known somebody that would be really great at this business if they just open their mind and listen for a minute, but they're skeptical. This is the website you would send them to. It'll respond to anything they've ever had an objection to in a very pragmatic, logical, rational way, you know, not with a bunch of hype and hoopla and stuff like that. So we've tentatively have titled this little organization we've got here together MAG, MMAG, Multi-Level Marketers Advocacy Group, and it is not a trade association. I want to make that very clear. I am not looking to start yet another trade association. We already have kind of a glut of trade associations out there right now. We certainly don't need another one, but I do think that there's some things on the agenda here that might be very intriguing to some people. So if you are interested in participating in this project, from the standpoint of funding, and it's very little of that actually would be needed, but we do need some. Basically, we need to hire a full-time coordinator. Otherwise, it's just going to languish in development hell, like most things in our trade associations are. Great ideas, a lot of great people, you know, coming up with the ideas, but who's going to do it? Well, everybody's already got their full-time gigs and you just can't get done in their spare time a little bit at a time. We need a full-time coordinator. So that's really what we're looking for as far as funding. Primarily, we need internet development, we need computer animation, video development, things like that. Anyone that can lend some of that to this project, it would be greatly appreciated. So if you're interested in doing that, by all means, you know, let me know. You can email me at mwave, like ocean wave, the letter M for market wave, of course, mwave1, the number one, don't spell it out, the numeral one. So mwave1 at cox.net, cox.net. Let me know that you are interested in being part of that group because we have weekly calls and we're really kind of fleshing out what this whole project's going to look like. And I think it's something that could be really, really great. So anyway, let's move on here because I'm still committed as I always was before to keeping these things to under an hour. I expect I'm going to fail miserably, but let's fail by only a half an hour instead of my 2-hour marathons, because I was still getting all of this feedback from a lot of you listeners where you say, Len, like don't make these so long. But it's a podcast. It's really at this point it's there's not even an RSS feed developed, so it's really an MP3 you download. You can stop it any time you want and come back and listen to it. Okay, you don't have to just keep listening as long as I talk. So I'll try to keep them short though. Agile. Now Agile is a company that that launched a few years ago. Actually, that was a big hit when it first came out. It was kind of based on gelseuticals, which I'll get to in a minute. But they've had a little bit of a drama recently because, first of all, Eric Worre, one of their top leaders, left and went over to Send Out Cards. This was a couple of years ago. They lost another one of their big leaders, Randy Schroeder, who actually went over to Mona V. And there's some other leaders that had moved around since then as well, too. But Randy Gage, who's, I think, their main leader, is still in Agile, and he's still 100% committed to Agile. So all the rumors out there, Randy leaving, that's not true. I got that straight from Randy. All right, he's still 100% Agile. He's not doing anything else. But then what happened was, back in November, and I've already outlined all of this in a previous alert, so go to the alert archive section on marketwaveinc.com. You can get all of this. So I'm not going to rehash it all here. But their founder and their CEO, Glenn Jensen, was asked to resign, or he got fired. It looks like he probably got fired because eventually they sued him, whatever you want to call it, but he did leave. Apparently, it was not by choice. So they sued him for all these things I've already outlined in the alert. Allegedly, he was thinking about starting another company, and he was talking to top distributors trying to get him over. I found out that was specific to Thailand, I believe, or one of the Asian markets. But what's happened since then, since the alert I sent out, which I don't want to spend time, like I said, rehashing now, is there has been some various different rumors and so forth that other people in corporate are leaving. I have confirmed. And some of the sources, you know, I've got to keep to myself, but trust me, I wouldn't repeat them unless these were good, solid sources. One of their executive VPs at corporate did recently resign, but that was more of a personal issue, dealing with long-distance traveling and family issues and things like that. It has nothing to do with the condition of Agile or any of that kind of stuff. Their director of IT, however, has resigned, I believe, next Thursday is his last day. He's given his notice, so he's still there now. But he has resigned, and he is moving on as well, too. But whether or not there's, you know, maybe he just got a better offer from another company, you know, there's all kinds of issues that could be involved with that. Corporate people and MLM companies move around all the time. It's just when one happens right after, you know, the drama of Eric leaving and then Glenn Jensen, you know, getting booted and sued and all this kind of stuff, it makes it kind of look like, oh, everybody's abandoning ship. This could just be par for the course, folks. Unfortunately, network marketing distributors, present company excluded, of course, they're a very fickle, flighty bunch, and they tend to spook very easily. You know, every little bump in the road is Mount Everest. Every little puff of smoke is a mushroom cloud. So the timing of it could look kind of bad and like, oh, okay, so Glenn's left, Eric's left, there's this VP leaves, the director of IT leaves, this really looks bad. Well, here's the thing. I think, and I'm only speculating now, I'll make that very, very clear. I think what will probably happen here is I think that Glenn is going to come back, perhaps as a figurehead or whatever. But see, Glenn Jensen, I know, was very, very popular, especially in the Asian markets. And if Glenn's gone, they're going to see, I believe, a lot of people leave in the Asian markets where most of their growth is. In Asia, and I think Italy, and I think a little bit in Russia is where most of their growth is right now. But still, these are the markets that are most important to them. And it's the last thing you want to do is take the person that they look up to, that they're most attached to, and have that person leave and get sued or whatever. There's a goodwill value to the personalities involved with the company. There was a very prominent company of several years ago that was being shopped around for sale. But the owner of that company was so aggrandized and so respected and so loved that people said, well, if that guy's not involved with this company anymore, its value is so much less. So no one was interested in buying out the company. But this is back in the 90s, a long time ago. But sometimes certain personalities in MLM companies can be can become a very integral part of the culture of that company. Now, in this case, I believe that it has occurred to some extent with Glenn, especially, like I said, in the foreign markets. And I think it wouldn't surprise me if they worked something out and Glenn eventually came back. You know, kind of like a Steve Jobs kind of thing. You know, when Apple, like, dumped Steve Jobs, it was his company, his own board, kicked him out of the Macintosh division. And then eventually, he came back and kind of saved the company. So who knows how that's going to work out. It'll be interesting to kind of follow that soap opera. But I did want to mention that there's a couple of other interesting things, kind of aside from all of this, that I found as I sort of researched it. It's kind of interesting. Agile, this gelsuticle product in itself, and some of you longtime listeners already know this. I interviewed Randy Gage several months ago, and we kind of talked about this a little bit. But I've never really understood what the value was to adding an inert thickening agent to a liquid nutritional product. How does turning it from just a liquid into a gel increase its efficacy or its value in any way? And I've asked that of many leaders in Agile. I've listened to doctors talk about supposedly how that's supposed to be better. And to this day, I cannot get an answer to that question. Now, understand, I'm not criticizing Agile's product. I'm sure the liquid itself is very nutritious. It's very good for you. I have no problem with that. It's strictly the issue of how does adding cellulose, one of the most common, you know, and virtually inert, it's a fiber-based product, but there's minute amount of fiber provide you. How does just making it thicker into a gel somehow increase the value or efficacy of that product? I can see why you wouldn't want to make it thicker, because in bulk it would make it heavier to ship. You would dilute the active ingredients with this inert substance, and more of it would remain inside the package and not be consumed. I mean, imagine if you had a pure liquid inside your toothpaste tube, you'd probably get every bit of it out of there eventually. But I actually saw, I think it was Consumer Reports or somebody, I forget who it was that published this, but somebody a few years ago said that on average they picked a bunch of toothpaste tubes out of the trash at the landfill site or something, and they said that on average there was anywhere from 2 to as many as 6 brushings left of toothpaste in every toothpaste tube that got thrown out. I'm actually shocked it was that little. You know, I mean, sometimes people just get it where you got to start pushing a little bit at the top and they go, I'm done with it, I'll just throw away, open up another one. But you never get all of that stuff out of there. So why make it thicker so more of it sticks inside there and doesn't get consumed and you got to keep doing that little squeegee thing to get it out? The best response I ever got was and this was a doctor that was speaking on behalf of Agile, said that somehow it keeps the nutrients suspended, which is kind of like saying it keeps the purple in grape juice suspended. Okay, the nutrients isn't the little bit of sediment that falls to the bottom of the bottle, which can be resolved by just doing a couple of quick shakes. The nutrients are on a molecular level. See, they don't settle. So, again, I've just never understood the value of that. But they have tried to expand out into other products, which I did predict several years ago. By the way, most of the predictions I get right, I never make public, so I can't brag about them. So when I publicly make a prediction that turns out to be right, indulge me, like, gloating a little bit. But they did. But where they expanded to, that's kind of my concern. For example, they have now a sublingual product that's an aphrodisiac or libido-enhancing product, and this is their terms, by the way. The problem with this is, according to the FDA, and I'm quoting here, any over-the-counter drug product that is labeled, represented, or promoted for use as an aphrodisiac, such as the disease condition impotence, are subject to, and then they go out and tell you the statutes that are subject to that statutes of the FDA guidelines. It goes on to say, these regulations require that such drugs be FDA approved before they can be marketed. And I paraphrase there slightly. And by drugs, they're also saying that if simply by saying you're an aphrodisiac or a libido-enhancing product, you cause the product to be classified as a drug. So, and this has been pretty well known in the industry now for years, that you don't say a dietary supplement enhances libido or can be used as an aphrodisiac or anything like that, let alone the fact it's sublingual. We already talked about this on a past show involving Enlighten with their gel strips. The FDA is very, very clear that if anything is absorbed sublingually under the tongue, or transbuccally, you know, between your cheek and gum, or transdermally through the skin, that in itself makes it no longer a dietary supplement, or like in the case of a diet patch, it makes it basically a drug device. So you have to ingest the product for it to be declared a dietary supplement. If it is not ingested to the digestive system, it's not a dietary supplement. The FDA is crystal clear on this, and I've cited the statutes and things in past alerts. Enlighten's response to this, by the way, was, well, there's some residual, like residue in your mouth that's incidentally swallowed after it's absorbed, and that goes to the digestive system. Well, I specifically asked the FDA, because I have a contact in the Washington office that is actually the office that sends out the warning letters. Like, this is the place where you would ask. And I didn't mention any company names or anything. I don't tattle on companies, but I asked this person specifically. If I don't bug him too much, he does respond. And I said, if a company's selling a sublingual product, or in this case it was sublingual, I said, if it's a sublingual product between the cheek and gum, some, you know, residual liquid was left over and incidentally swallowed, does that get them off the hook? Could that still be declared a dietary supplement? And his response back was emphatically, no, it does not. That would still be declared a drug in the eyes of the FDA. By the way, I'm not saying I agree with any of this or anything. I'm just the messenger, right? This is what the FDA has said. And in the case of Agile's product, I mean, they talk about how these gel strips, one of the advantages over traditional forms of dietary supplements is that it, see, I'm looking for the actual quote here. Here we go. I got the quote. Has many advantages over traditional forms such as ingestible tablets. So it's the advantage over something that's ingestible. So they're very clearly saying that it's not ingested, it's sublingually absorbed. There is no question that that would cause the FDA to cause it to go from a dietary supplement to a drug. And there's numerous warning letters. Again, I've linked to them in past alerts. You'll see them all there. You can go to the FDA website, fda.gov, just search their warning letters, lower right-hand corner of the homepage, click on warning letters. You know, search for terms like aphrodisiac, search for the term libido, search for the term sublingual. Search the entire FDA website for the term sublingual. You'll see all kinds of references to why you simply cannot sell a dietary supplement as a sublingual or transdermal product, which gets us to the FLX rub. And this is a topical gel that I'm quoting now from the Agile website, designed to penetrate deep into sore muscles and joint tissue. Besides the FTC possibly getting involved, because that would be perhaps a deceptive trade practice, I'm speculating. But that would only be because I've never heard ever of a topical gel or any kind of topical cream that will go all the way through the skin, all the way through all the different layers of tissue, down into the actual joint. Now, I can see it going into the bloodstream and traveling all around your body and somehow getting into that joint, but that's not what it says here. You rub this stuff on your joint and it penetrates deep into the sore muscle tissue and all the way down into the joint tissue. I don't believe that's true, and I don't believe it's physically possible. But even if we take that off the table, because that's where the FTC would come in, is the statement truthful or not? They care about advertising claims. How is that not a transdermal product? They're declaring it to be transdermal, dermal meaning skin. If it's absorbed through the skin, by the way, this is my concern with pretty much all topical products. If it stays right on the surface and doesn't penetrate, how does it do anything to the joint? And if it does penetrate, then it's transdermal and the FDA says it's a drug. So how do you get around that? I don't know. I'm just posing some concerns here, but yeah, I think that Agile at some point in the future may have to kind of rethink the expansion of their product line here as well too. But ultimately, I think Agile is going to survive this. I think my prediction, my theory is Glenn will actually come back and everything will be pretty much back to business as usual here probably in the next few weeks or months. So, well, no, we'll see what happens, see if I got that one right. The IV7 company. Now, IV7 is a company I came across a little before the holidays. It's a fairly new company, and they're selling a topical disinfectant, a spray. And you squirt this spray onto surfaces, and it will disinfect the surface, and it will do it in such a way where it kills pretty much everything, and it does it very, very quickly. I know it is. I've researched this a lot. I've spoken to a lot of manufacturers. This is how come I never scoop anybody, by the way. You know, all these guys out there, Lou and Ted and Troy and Corey and Rod, all you guys know who you are. You know, they always scoop me on these things because instead of just getting the information out there, I got to go do all this research and I call these people. I'm not saying that nothing's wrong with the way they did it. They get the information out. But I always like dig way into it. So I'm always the last one to get information out because I'm interviewing all these people and doing all this research and everything, trying to learn more about it and kind of make a, you know, more elaborate kind of story around it. But in the process of doing that, I learned a lot about topical disinfectants and sanitizing surfaces and things like that. And I found out most everything will kill everything. I mean, literally you could spray Windex on the surface of your kitchen counter and it's going to kill everything on there. It's a matter of how fast does it kill it and how long does everything stay disinfected on that surface. Like with Windex, you wipe it away and within a few minutes later it can get reinfected. And again, sometimes these things take several minutes, sometimes over an hour to kill everything on the surface, whereas you really want it to be killed instantaneously. So those are the kind of the factors you got to look for. They've got a very good product that does that. I have absolutely no problem with that at all. They've got a product based on what they call silver dihydrogen citrate, I believe it is, SDC for short. And this stuff has been shown to kill everything very quickly, and it keeps everything on the surface disinfected for a very, very long period of time. So from that standpoint, great product. No problem with that at all. But let's go to a list of questions that I sent to corporate, because I've always made a habit of doing this for the last 20 years. By the way, if you hear a lot of jets going in the background, it's because I live just south of Nellis Air Force Base. Nothing I can do about it. But anyway, I always try to get the corporate side first before I ever rip on a company. Like, okay, you guys, like, you know, here's my concerns, here's my questions. Here's what usually happens. They ignore me. I go forward with what I know. I get a letter from their attorney saying about, you know, all the stuff I got wrong and, you know, all my misinformation I put out. They want a retraction, apology, clarification. I'll write back to them and say, okay, that's great, but you forgot to mention what I got wrong. And I really tried to get you to vet all of my information before I went published with it, so, you know, public with it. But, okay, so what did I get wrong? Be specific, and I promise I'll clarify it and I'll change it and apologize for it, and then I never hear from them again. By the way, that's exactly what happened to Prepay Legal. This was, you know, I said some things about them in one of my newsletters. I think back in 2002, more recently, but still like, you know, 9 years ago, I wrote a fairly negative piece about them. And I tried so hard to get somebody at corporate to vet the article, a fairly lengthy article, did a pretty detailed treatment of them before I went public with it. And they refused to do it. They acknowledged they got it, and they just refused to do it. And, of course, as soon as I went public with it, I got the letter from the attorney saying, well, you got all this stuff wrong. And I wrote them back and said, yeah, you forgot to mention what I got wrong. What was it? Just tell me, I'll fix it. Never heard from them again. So I'm not saying that's going to happen here. I'm just saying that's typically what happens when I try to do this. Sometimes companies will respond, and they'll really make an effort to respond to my questions and answer them. And I realize, you know what? I misinterpreted a lot of stuff, and I got it wrong. That may happen here. Because I did get confirmation that corporate did receive this, so they can't say, we don't know what Len's talking about, we never got this information or these questions. They did get them. For whatever reason, it's been over 2 months now, they've chosen not to respond. So I did my best. So here we go. In their compensation plan literature, online, and this is on the corporate website, you can forgive a lot of stuff that overzealous distributors might produce on their websites. This is the corporate website now. They keep referring to how much product you have to buy to qualify in their compensation plan. Now, for those of you who may be fairly new to the industry, a distributor should never have to buy their quota. Okay, you have to count retail sales to other people outside of the compensation plan. In other words, you have to be able to earn your monthly quota by selling the product. You don't have to do it out of your own pocket. Many of us do. I'm just saying you don't have to. So you would never want to say you buy a $200 silver package, $400 gold package, or $800 platinum package, as the case here. You would never buy that volume yourself. You would have to achieve that amount of personal volume. Personal volume is achieved by your own personal purchases or sales to others. So you just say you achieve this amount of volume, however you achieve it, but don't specifically declare you buy it, because then if distributors buying the volume is the only way the volume occurs, you have to recruit to make money. It becomes an indirect recruiting bonus because only new recruits create this volume, because the new recruits, the distributors, the ones buying it. Now, in reality here, sales to outside distributors do count. It's sort of like Effusion a few months ago. They had the same thing. Outside sales, allegedly, according to their CEO, did count toward the monthly quota, but they didn't declare it anywhere in their literature. In their literature, they said the distributors have to buy the product, which eventually got them sued for being a pyramid, which was resolved. But still, the point, that was the catalyst to it. So here, again, the language. Did a consultant ever read this? Did an MLM attorney ever review this and approve it? I can't believe it, because, you know, no attorney would ever say, look, you can't say you buy one of these three packages to meet your quota. They talk about, again, I'm quoting here, purchasing $800 in qualified products to become active, or what they call binary active. It says an IBA must accumulate a minimum of $200 in, quote-unquote, purchases within their first 30 days. No, you can accumulate that in sales, however you can get the sale, not from your own personal purchases. So that was the first red flag there. So my question is then, by the way, are distributor purchases the only way to meet these qualifications? That is, you know, do sales to outside customers count towards each of these initial qualifications? And I've been told by one of their distributors that it does, but I've never got that confirmation from corporate, and it doesn't say that anyplace on their literature. The next question I asked them was, is that, as I understand it, an associate can upgrade to a platinum business center, in a higher grade of position in the binary plan, after 30 days for a one-time purchase of an $800 gold business center upgrade. They can also upgrade to what they call a platinum center for a one-time purchase of $1,600 in product. They call that the platinum center upgrade. And I asked them, are distributor purchases the only way to meet these qualifications? Now, as I understand it, the answer to that question is yes. Okay, if you want these upgrades, if you don't do it in the first 30 days and you want these upgrades, the distributor must buy these upgrade packages. So again, if that's the only way to do it, then distributors are the only ones producing that volume, thus you must recruit to make money. That would be the legal concern there. It says in their compensation plan, this was my third question, and I'm going to quote them here from their compensation plan. By the way, all of which I just checked, and even though I sent this to them 2 months ago, everything I'm about to describe to you is still there. So not only did they not respond to any of these things, and believe me, they get worse, they've not even fixed any of them. Because here's the quote. Independent of any individual business center earnings cap, there is a maximum global payout cap set by the company. If the total commission payout exceeds this cap, then the percentage of overage is applied as a commission reduction to all IBAs. For example, if the global commission cap was 50%, and after calculating all commissions, the total payout is 53%, each IBA's commission check will be reduced by 3%. This is done to ensure the viability of the company, end quote. Now, the fact they have a cap, no problem. Most companies today, especially binaries, have a cap. Because without this cap, there's this thing called binary creep, a phenomenon pretty much specific to binaries, where the bigger the company gets, the higher the payout goes. The growth and the increase in payout will take them over their cap, they'll have to cut pay. Most binaries, if they last long enough, go over their cap and have to cut pay. And why that happens, by the way, that's going to be a discussion for a future show. But I won't get into detail, just trust me right now, that happens. So they've put something in here to make sure they don't overpay and to account for how they're going to do it, which is perfectly fine. Many companies have done this. But wouldn't this 53% payout have to be cut by 5.7% to get to 50%? Any math majors out there like I was? Think about it. If you get 53 minus 50 is 3. 3 divided into 53, that's 5.67. So they just said they're going to take the 3%, but they're not really doing that. Just they're going to have to cut the pay by 5.7%. Not only that, but what if the payout was 56%? You got to cut it down to 50. They've got to cut their pay by 10.7% to get back to 50%, not 6%. So again, I know that sounds like I'm picking nits, but this is their publicly declared literature, and distributors are seeing how the percentages are going to get cut, and they're claiming they're going to be cutting them by significantly less than they're actually going to be cutting them. And I think that's an important factor. Maybe, I don't know, I'm probably being a little picky on that one, I agree. But like I said, I'm kind of really going in ascending order here, so bear with me. Question number four. I said in their compensation plan, there's a chart that shows a, quote-unquote, total commission payout, end quote, of up to 50%, based on the sum of 35% in their unilevel bonuses, you know, all the different levels down their unilevel, add all those up, they pay 35%. And the 15% matching bonus payout. In other words, they've taken the 35% they pay in commissions from the unilevel, a 15% matching bonus that they pay on those commissions. In other words, if you sign someone up and they earn $100 in commissions from the unilevel, you're going to earn a $15 matching bonus, potentially as much as that. The company will pay out as much as 15% of that matching bonus. It's spread to several different people, down more than one generation. But the point is, it's a match of the commission. Isn't the matching bonus payout, that's 15%, isn't that 15% of the 35%? Right? It's not 15% of the volume that's moved. It's 15% of the 35% commission. In other words, if IV7 paid out $350 in unilevel commissions on $1,000 of bonus volume, Okay, that's that 35%. Wouldn't you then pay a potential 15% match of that 350 commission? Because that's what you're matching. And if so, wouldn't this add up to, I think this would add an additional 5.25% to the overall payout. Whereas, again, 15% of 35%. So the actual total payout is 40.25%. Now that's significant. They put that 35% unilevel, the 15% match, and they've made this very fundamental blunder of just adding the two together and saying that makes a 50% payout. Now, I'm not trying to be technical here. This is a major, major blunder. Okay, you don't add those two together to get your total payout. Okay, it's not 15 plus 35. It's 15% of the 35 gets added to the 35. That's 40.25, not 50. They're off by a full, well, almost 20%, actually, but 10% points difference. So, yeah, when they're saying they're paying out 50%, they're really paying out 40.25. That's a major, major error. Like I said, they're fully aware now that that's what their website says, and it still says it. Now, number five, I said, is it correct that the average product BV, bonus volume, to wholesale ratio is 80%? In other words, they claim that the amount of points they apply to their products is roughly about 80% of the actual wholesale price of the product. Now, nothing wrong with that. There's BVs and CVs, bonus volume, commissionable volume, whatever they call it. These points that they actually pay on, that's very common. The large majority of companies do that today. 80%, very reasonable BV to wholesale ratio. You know, a $10 product is 8 BV. Nothing wrong with that. The concern I have here, and what I tried to get them to verify, is they're declaring their total payout is 50% of the unit levels and the matching bonus. But if it's really 40.25, and that 40.25 is on the points, and the points are 80% of the actual dollar, then isn't their actual payout on wholesale dollars 32.2%? In other words, 80% of 40.25. So if we really render this number down, their actual payout on dollars appears to be 32.2%, making them one of the lowest payouts in the industry, as opposed to the 50% they're declaring, which actually make them a relatively high payout. I mean, that is significant, and this appears to be the math right on their website. I just asked them to simply clarify it. I kind of understand, I guess, why they didn't want to clarify that, because I think that's true. Number six, in your compensation plan document, they state things like this, and I'm quoting. Listen to this carefully. The first 30 days of purchases from each IBA, that's what they call their distributors, are paid out in the binary plan. All purchases after the initial 30-day enrollment period are paid into the unilevel plan. So I asked them, I said, well, now binary and unilevel plans are, they have diametrically opposing downline building philosophies. Binaries you build in depth, unilevels you build in width. I said, can you briefly explain the benefit to creating this dichotomy, you know, with your compensation plan? What does it incentivize? Because, by the way, no compensation plan should be designed to compensate. Okay, as any good, competent compensation plan designer should tell you, of which, by the way, that's a minority of all compensation plan designers out there, but they should tell you, a compensation plan is not designed to compensate. It's designed to incentivize. So every single aspect of your plan, there should be an answer to this question. What activity or behavior does this incentivize? So what does this incentivize? I said, is it correct that someone can be your downline partner in their first month in the binary, but a cross-line competitor in all months after that? Because you're building basically two by two in the binary, but in the unilevel, it's financially to your advantage to put everybody as wide as you can across your front line. So somebody can be a downline partner in one and a cross-line competitor in the other. By the way, I still have no idea if this is even how they do it. This is how they say they do it, but this could be a misinterpretation based on some poorly worded documentation. I don't know. I would think that it would be very, very unusual for anyone to have ever recommended that you do this. You build in the first 30 days, you're in a completely different kind of comp plan than all the volume after that. So again, I might be misinterpreting this, but who knows? They didn't want to answer my questions about whether or not that's really how it works or not. So, but that's how they say it works. Number seven, they describe dynamic compression as being employed in their compensation plan. Well, dynamic compression and standard compression are two different forms of compression. Okay, the section of their compensation plan that they have titled, quote-unquote, dynamic compression, goes on to describe what would be standard compression. So I asked them, you know, which form do they actually use? Now, again, I do not belabor on a lot of technicality. I don't want to get into the difference between dynamic compression and standard compression at this point. Maybe I'll do that for another day. If any of you out there are interested in knowing that, email me, let me know. You know, I'll discuss it at some point. For right now, just understand there are two different types of compression, and they claim they have one type, which is the better type, but then they describe the other type. So I think they're using the word dynamic more generically, like it's just really great, cool compression, it's dynamic, not understanding that that's a name of a specific type of compression that's common in the industry, and that's not the kind that they're actually using. Anyway, number eight, I said, as I understand it, new reps are allowed to qualify for up to 2 months, technically less than 1 day, with their first qualifying order. That is, if you enroll someone on the 2nd of November, their qualifying order qualifies them for November and December. So in other words, part of the first month they're already in, and their entire second month. So you get 1 full month of qualification for sure, and whatever part of the previous month. Okay, that's what you qualify for. But another prospect could be enrolled on November 30th and only qualify for 1 month plus 1 day. In other words, they'd qualify for all of December and just 1 day of November. And then I went on to ask, wouldn't this make it more difficult to enroll anyone during the second half of any month, and almost impossible to enroll someone the last few days of the month? I mean, think about that. If you're a distributor and you understood the compensation plan, and it's November 29th, wouldn't you wait a couple of days to enroll? It's December 20th. I mean, I'd probably wait, you know, until December 1st to enroll, because that way I get all of December and January. But if I enroll that last week of November, I just get those few days of November and all of December. So, you know, again, there's a huge incentive here, it would seem, for distributors during the last half of the month to delay enrolling. So I didn't understand what the benefit was to doing that. So I asked him, well, you know, what's the upside to this qualification? You know, what's sort of the method to the madness here? Still don't know the answer to that question. Number nine, personal sales volume is described as, and I'm quoting, the sum total of the wholesale value of purchases made by an associate through the dealer cart in their IV7 direct business headquarters. That's essentially their back office. And any retail purchases made through the IBA's replicating web store. End quote. So I went on and says, do orders placed by phone, fax, or regular mail count toward an IBA's PSV? What about preferred customers on AutoShip? Again, all of those would have been outside of the description that they just gave as to what counts toward PSV. I gotta believe all that other stuff does count. The best case is it does count and they just declared it didn't, which is not good, or it actually doesn't count, which is even worse. So it's degrees of negative here, but anyway, it's still what it says. Number 10, has the IV7 compensation plan document been reviewed by a qualified editor? And the reason I ask this question is, besides some of the other things earlier that were just, I have a very strong feeling, aren't really issues with their plan, they're issues with the way they were described in their literature. They're just worded improperly. But they also go on to say things like this. In the section titled Compensation Cap Global, compensation cap hyphen global, there's an example where it says, and I'm quoting, the company wishes to pay out 100% of the BV for the period for easy math, they say in parenthesis. However, this, you know, they're sort of saying like, okay, like obviously we're not going to pay out 100% of the bonus volume. You know, they're going to pay out 50% like they said earlier. But they're going to say 100% just for easier math. I still would question that. I mean, most people can in their mind figure out what half of something is, use 50%, be more realistic. But I get it. Okay, they want to make it easier math. But then they go on to say, I mean, this whole section actually I'm talking about begins by explicitly stating that IV7 intends to pay out literally, and I'm quoting, no more than 100% of the total BV invoice for a commission period, end quote. That's a typo, right? I mean, they mean 50%. You can't pay out 100% of all of your commissionable volume. That $10 product, if it's 8 BV, you don't pay out 100% of the 8 BV. That's an 80% payout of wholesale in that arbitrary example I just gave. They don't really mean that, but that's what they say. They literally say they pay out 100% of their total BV. I got a feeling that's just bad editing. They don't really do that. They say things like, in the same section I just described, there's a calculation to how they would perform the payout shaving. You know, should it overpay, which results in a 3% commission cut. Well, even using their math, this calculation actually results in a 2.44% cut. Now, in other words, 2.44 doesn't even round up to 3%. So if you're going to round, you would round down, wouldn't you? Anyway, again, it sounds petty, but I'm pointing out examples of just bad editing. These are typos. These are mathematical errors that are in there that, you know, just clean them up a little bit. But this is all within the context of asking them if anyone's actually had any kind of professional editing done of the literature. Under the section titled Generational Bonus, the example states, I'm quoting, Steve is 57 levels below you and is in your personal line of sponsorship. As a level 5 IBA, you would earn a 2% override commission for all business volume, BV, in your line of sponsorship for all 55 levels between you and Steve. Okay, Steve's on my 57th level. Wouldn't there be 56 people between me and Steve? Again, it's just an editing question. Did anyone ever review this and go, wait a minute, that number 55 should be 56? But the point is that even after we were made aware of these typos, they're all still in the website. I went on to ask them things like, you know, what is their actual global payout cap? Because they proposed one as theoretical in their literature. Like, if it was this, this is how we would do it. Well, what is it really? They didn't really say. In their policies and procedures, there's a clause that states, and again I'm quoting, product return and repurchase, that's the name of the section, all products in resaleable condition purchased within 90 days prior to termination may be returned to the company. Company will repurchase such products at 90% of the original price, less any bonus or commissions paid, end quote. Now that clause, by the way, is in most companies' policies and procedures. It's probably in yours. But here's the question. You get a 90% refund on the product you return, less any bonus or commissions paid. Is that less any bonus or commissions paid upline or to you? There's a huge difference. If it's less any commissions or bonuses paid to you, and you're returning your product because you didn't make any money in the business and you want to quit, you're probably going to get the full 90% refund. Or maybe if you got a couple of $20 checks or something and you quit, that last one, maybe they'll knock that off. But if they mean less any bonuses or commissions paid on the product you're returning, in other words, to all the people upline from you that got a piece of that product and they got a 50% payout, you're getting a 90% of 50% refund, and that's a big difference. So this is actually not an issue with IV7 so much as it is with most companies that have this clause. It's really, really ambiguous as to what they're talking about, and they really need to declare it. Okay, what are they talking about when they say less any bonuses or commissions paid? In this case, by the way, how do you declare it? You ask your company, what do you mean by this? Can you please clarify? And they'll tell you. Well, here I asked, and they chose not to tell me. Number 13 is more of a, not really a question for the public. It's not relevant. You guys wouldn't care about it. Don't worry about that one. Number 14. And I saved the best till last. This is the question that was by far the most critical. It is the question that I believe will make or break this company. And based on my personal opinion, I think will probably be the demise of this company. This is why they're probably not going to succeed. I asked them, is it true that there are a number of SDC, silver dihydrogen citrate, products licensed by Pure Sciences, that's the company, the one that developed the product, which are essentially identical to the LV7 product, being sold online and in retail stores for about half the distributor cost. And I went on to give them some examples. There's a company called Pure Green 24, at puregreen24.com. It's not an MLM company. But they're selling a 32-ounce bottle of a topical disinfectant with SDC, the exact same substance. So it was basically same product, just different label, for $12.99. BioCate Plus, which is $9.99 for a 32-ounce bottle, can be bought online. Spectra San 24 at SpectraSan.com, $11.99 for a 32-ounce bottle, and that was on the Walgreens website. Again, identical product, different label. All of them selling for about half the distributor cost for the IV7 product through that company. It's $20.99, $30 suggested retail. Yet here's three different competitors, two of which, by the way, I spoke to, SpectraSan and Pure Green 24, and confirmed they're still in business. I got a response from more than one distributor that said, oh, these companies are just depleting inventory, they've lost their license, they're not going to be able to sell it anymore, and, you know, IV27 is going to have an exclusive. Well, when I called these companies and asked them if that was true, they were vehement in their response that no, it is not. In fact, both of them just confirmed very large, substantial reorders, one they just placed and one they just received. So, no, these competitors are still out there. They're going to be out there for apparently quite a while, at least two of the three of them. The BioCate Plus is the only one I didn't confirm. But yeah, they're out there. So the parent company, Pure Bioscience, publicly traded. You can go online and look at their 10-Ks, and they say right in there, that we resell this substance to private labelers, and you know it could be marketed all over the place out there. So again, they don't have an exclusive on it. In network marketing, you really have to have an exclusive. You can't have a product the distributors are paying $21 for that you're supposed to sell it for $30 retail when the identical product with a different brand name on it is being sold retail in stores or online for half the distributor price. Even if they popularize this product, which they could very well do. I mean, this stuff's supposed to do some amazing things. You put it in drinking water and it disinfects it and all the, you know, that entails and impoverished nations and things like that with bad drinking water. Great stuff can be done with this product. I'm not questioning that. But how do you sell it for a distributor cost, let alone the 30 suggested retail, when you can get the exact same thing by going to Walgreens.com and buying SpectraSan 24 for $12? Or go to Pure Greens and buy it for, you know, 13? Well, it gets worse. I recently discovered, if you go to OfficeDepot.com, you will not only find another SDC product selling a 32-ounce spray bottle of it for $13.37, still well below the price that IV7 offers, but it's the IV7 product, the actual exact same IV7 product, not a different branding. So they're selling it by MLM, and they're selling it retail in direct competition with their own distributors. OfficeDepot.com, look for IV, like the thing you stick in your arm at the hospital. I kind of question how they came up with the name, too. But anyway, IV with either a space or a hyphen and the number 7. Look it up at OfficeDepot.com. I checked it out just 2 nights ago. It was still there. So there it is. So even if they popularize this product, why would any regular customer of this product ever spend $30 or even sign up as a distributor and spend $21 where they can just pop over to Walgreens or Office Depot online and buy the same thing for $12 or $13? I don't know. It doesn't look good. There's some really, really good people have gotten involved with this company too. Now they claim that they're in pre-launch. They claim their actual launch is still upcoming. So they've got some time to make some corrections here. But the biggest thing they got to do is, first of all, when they're notified of mistakes like this, they should fix them. Or at least clarify the things that the guy who's asking you got wrong so he doesn't do podcasts like this where he's portraying your company incorrectly. And you got to find a way to get your product off the market so your distributors can sell it for the price you've told them you suggested they should sell it for. And I doubt that's going to happen. That's a pretty big undertaking. Now, before we get to the doghouse and an update on Eero, because there's a nice little soap opera and some drama going on there too, I think you're going to be interested in. These are actual... You know, I try to make them really like an actual show, like a radio show, and I actually have paid advertisers. Now, some of these people are more like a barter thing that I do with them or whatever, but there is compensation involved. And, you know, I really hope that, it's only 30 seconds, 60 seconds. The longest you're ever going to have to listen to a commercial break is probably 2 minutes. Please listen to them and check out the people that support this show and support what we do here at Market Wave. You know, and consider working with them. They're always generic. No MLM companies are ever pitched here. So again, check out the commercial breaks. Listen to what's offered. By the way, if anyone wants to advertise on this show, again, email me. Let me know. I can give you the demographics and the numbers and all that kind of stuff. But basically, for right now, $95 will get you 3 shows. You get a 60-second spot for $95. You can get a 30-second spot for $75. And that, again, that gets you 3 shows. So it's, you know, check it out. If you're interested, email me. Let me know. MWAVE1. MWAVE, the number 1, at Cox.net. You can also leave a message for me anytime at 800-688-4766. Got to get out of the habit of repeating things, too, because you can always just go back a few seconds, can't you? This isn't live. But anyway, if you're too lazy to do that, 800-688-4766. There it is again. So anyway, we'll be back here in this case, it's only a minute. So hang in there. We'll be back in 1 minute.
Since 1992, TeleCenter has been the ultimate lead capture and communication tool for direct sales professionals. TeleCenter is a toll-free number you will use in all of your advertising to provide 24/7 recorded information about your company, products, and opportunity. As prospects listen to the pre-recorded messages, the system pre-qualifies them for you and then instantly notifies you via text, phone, and email. The constant flow of fresh, qualified leads will drive momentum into your business. TeleCenter even captures every caller's phone number, their name and address when available, serves as a 24/7 fax system, provides a 25-user conference bridge, an ad tracker to define your best advertising responses, and so much more. with a simple flat rate price, over 35 included features, and no service contract, TeleCenter is the right choice for successful direct sellers. Learn more and sign up online now by going to www.telecentersignup.com/marketwave or by finding the TeleCenter banner in the MLM resources section of marketwaveinc.com.
All right, we are back. And in this segment of the show, I want to get into the doghouse. And this is a segment that's kind of, it's facetious. I'm going to have a little fun with it. Sometimes I'll probably get serious with it. But in this case, this is just something I find kind of amusing. There is a gentleman out there that started up a company called 124. O-N-E, the number 24. Not to be mistaken with 1021. Which is Richard Brooks' new company, kind of a spinoff of OxyFresh there, different company. This one's 124. His name is Mark Seyforth, S-E-Y-F-O-R-T-H. I don't know Mark personally, and again, it's not a knock on him personally, just with some of the information that he's presenting. According to Mark, he invented network marketing, at least the network marketing compensation plan, back in the mid-70s. In fact, here is his description of exactly how Mark invented multi-level marketing.
Hello, my name is Mark Seyforth, and during the next few minutes, I'm going to share with you the first IRP, incentivized referral plan, in the United States. Why is that important to you? Because 35 years ago, there were only direct sales companies, and when I wrote the first multi-level commissioning program, a whole new industry was born. Multi-level marketing, or as it's called today, MLM, and it swept the country. The result, my corporation, Seyforth Laboratories, became the fastest growing company in the United States at that time. Now it's 35 years later, and you have the opportunity to be the...
By the way, I did attempt to contact Mark about this, and we had scheduled a call through an intermediary. And at the scheduled time that we were supposed to speak, he was at the tarmac of apparently it sounded like a private airport, about to get on an airplane. I heard a prop, you know, kind of spinning in the background there, and he couldn't really talk, and so we never really had that conversation. But I mean, come on, what can he say? He did not invent multi-level marketing, obviously, back in the mid-70s, or there's no way you could even rationalize how that statement might be in any way true. I've always wanted to ask Mark, you know, if he was aware of a company called Shackley or Amway, Mary Kay Cosmetics, you know, any of those companies that were been around since the 50s or Mary Kay Case 63 that had this multi-level marketing compensation plan, even though Mary Kay Cosmetics will actually threaten to sue you if you call them a multi-level marketing company, but that's another story. Yeah, they use dual marketing, which means there's two ways to make money, by retail sales and also overrides from sales of others in your downline, where there's multiple levels of people marketing. Anyway, yeah, the multi-level compensation plan was around a little bit earlier than when Mark allegedly invented it. So, you know, if you're going to just make up crap like that, God, shouldn't you at least be like in the ballpark? Because it kind of like hurts the credibility of everything else you say. And I could, by the way, go on and do an expose, kind of the same thing I did of IV7 with the 124 program and how they only allow you to recruit one person a month. There'll be a lot of desire to like get in the loop, hold things back from people. They want it more or whatever. I mean, literally, this is a company that forbids you from enrolling more than one person a month. You get these little chips or these vouchers, and you got to wait in line. So if you want to join today and you're 12th person in line, you got to wait 12 months. So, yeah, I could probably go another hour on just this concept. But for right now, Mark, you get in the doghouse, at least for one show, because you said you invented multi-level marketing and didn't invent multi-level marketing. Now, Eero Research. This is E-I-R-O Research. Most of you listening to this probably are listening to this because of the alert I just sent out, which outlines a lot of things about their history and things like that. So I'm not going to rehash it all here. Again, if you want to learn about that, just go to marketwaveinc.com, look in the MarketWave Alert archives, you know, where there's like written alerts I send out. You can also subscribe to that too in the upper left-hand corner, or just go to the alert archives. And if that's not how you got here to this show, this is a company that just recently went out of business last week, and they allegedly had their second best month ever last October when they came out with a new skincare line. And so they were doing pretty well going into the end of last year, but for whatever reason, they decided last Tuesday to just... Actually, it was Wednesday morning, I believe it was, the 19th. to just close their doors and the company's out of business. Now, I've heard a lot of stuff out there and a lot of chatter on the internet, people talking, on radio shows and things like that, that, we got to sue this company. What a horrible thing that they did. They just like all of their distributors are just out of business. And the people are likening this to the Accelerate situation, which, by the way, Accelerate announced that they were abandoning network marketing and they were going retail. And this was they were spelled X-E-L-R, then the number 8, if anyone wants to look them up. It was 1 year ago to the day, exactly 1 year ago. If they announced they were doing this, that Eero announced that they were going out of business. Well, here's the thing. As I said in the alert, sometimes a company just goes out of business. They didn't stay in business and say, we're kicking all of you guys out. We're going to keep selling our product. We're still Eero Research. We're just going to go retail and put our products in stores or whatever, like happened to my first company back in 79. They said, we're out of business. And people, sometimes companies just go out of business. And if they're not making enough money to stay in business, you can't sue them because they chose to stop losing money or to stop making promises they knew they couldn't keep, you don't do that. Eventually, you just don't have any money left, and you have to go out of business. It's a horrible thing, but, it sucks, obviously. But they just go out of business, and that's what happened here. Now, like I said in the alert, how you go out of business, that's a different story, and that sometimes is worthy of some scorn here. Now, the SkinCeuticals, that was the name of the old company they had for about 10 years that they sold out to L'Oreal, and these guys decided a few years later to start Eero Research. So they got a lot of skin care background going on here. Well, the first thing that, that I think has been attributed to the, and I think did factor probably into this to some extent, was the fact that what they said was a 1 month supply of this product ended up being about a 3 month supply. It lasted three times longer than they said that they was going to, which makes a big difference in your revenue. Like, when you have a big hit of volume in October of 2010, it's no coincidence that their second best month ever was the same month they came out with this new product line. Everybody wants to try the new product. That's common in the industry. Even if you already had your auto ship order, you don't want to wait a month to try the new product, so you order extra product. Now, if that's the case, and you expect all that volume to occur again in November, then again in December, but it doesn't happen again until January, because it lasted for 3 months instead of 1 month, that can definitely hurt your bottom line. But again, allegedly, through very reliable sources, their downturn could have been attributed to the fact that there was not a very good reaction amongst a lot of people to the product. I've got some specifics as to what kind of reactions they were, but I cannot find any corroborating evidence where I can point to you and say, here's how I know that. But there's no question that there definitely was some dissatisfaction with the product. There also could have been some high overhead, because most network marketing companies, their marketing and advertising expense is their commission plan, right? They don't pay for advertising. You don't usually see a lot of billboards and TV commercials and things like that. You do in rare exceptions. Amway's doing it now and things like that because they got the money. But it's very unusual that you see that, because typically what would have been your advertising and marketing budget goes into your compensation plan. And your distributors, who are using word-of-mouth advertising, become your advertising budget. So you don't see a very significant advertising expense in most network marketing companies, profit and loss statements and balance sheets and things like that, because, that's your compensation plan. Well, here, Video Plus publishes Success from Home magazine and also Your Business at Home magazine, these glossy, full-color magazines, and they're very well produced. And by the way, this is nothing against Video Plus. I mean, they really do a great job with these magazines, and they're great credibility builders. Most people whose companies are featured in these magazines show them off like, isn't this great? This magazine devoted almost the entire article to our company. And there's a few other more generic articles in there and things like that. But for the most part, it's good. At least 80% of the content's about that company. Of course, reality, they paid for it. They paid and said, make this magazine about us in the next issue. And the cost can be as high as $150,000. This is a very big budget, professionally produced publication. They don't skim. Video Plus does a world-class job with this thing, and it's not cheap. But if you're going to spend $150,000, in this case, Eero CFO, as I understand it, used to actually work for Video Plus, so maybe he might have had connections, and maybe they got a discount or something like that. But still, it's a substantial expense. But once you've done that and you created this credibility tool, because that's really what it is, it's a sales aid. It's a credibility tool. In fact, I've seen Eero Research distributors market this in such a way, it's like, isn't this great? They devoted three issues to us. Well, no, it means you paid for it three times. But anyway, the point is that once you have that credibility tool, why would you ever pay another $150,000 or whatever the large sum was for a second one just a few months later? let alone a third one. And Euro had one of these giant budget publications produced three times. And the latest one was the January 2011 issue, the month in which they didn't even make it to the end of. Now understand, that probably was booked. The decision was made to do that months ago. I mean, it takes a long time to produce one of these things. I mean, that could have been a decision that could have possibly been made as far back as last summer. But certainly, that wasn't a recent decision. It was made at the time. Obviously, they didn't know that they were going to be out of business in the month the issue comes out. But still, that's a huge expense over and above your already existing commission expense, just to create a credibility tool. Now, I get that new product lines come out and you want to showcase that new product, but spend the $150,000 on the first one. When you come out with your new skincare line, put a nice glossy full-color page and throw it in there as what they call a one-up, a single sheet front and back page, you know, and just throw it in the already existing magazine. You still have the credibility of the magazine. You don't need to spend, for three of these things, $350,000, assuming they paid the maximum. That's a pretty big overhead. So here's what happened. On Thursday, that was January 13th, their president, Dave Fleming, resigned. Okay, we know that that happened that Thursday. Then on Friday, there was a letter sent out to the field by corporate saying things like, we're looking forward to a great new year and we're going to be closed Monday for the Martin Luther King holiday. Just, you know, business as usual type of stuff. Then, and I know that there was some contact between some of the leaders in corporate earlier that day, but then by Friday afternoon, everybody goes dark. The company goes dark, they say. In other words, no contact. Everything ends. And allegedly, there are some top leaders, more than one, that just sent hundreds of emails and telephone calls, and on Facebook, they tried to contact these people at corporate, and just everybody just stops talking. And then there's a training call every Saturday that some of the founding distributors put on, and they can see what phone numbers are on there. I use probably, I think, the same service, where you can see the phone numbers of all the people on the call so they could verify that members of corporate were on that call, just listening in, not participating, but just listening in to see that, you know, that business as usual again, everything's still going okay. Of course, Sunday was a holiday, Monday was a holiday, but then Tuesday, no one's even answering the phone at the home office. It goes straight to voicemail. The customer service line goes straight to voicemail. No live operator now, but it's still telling you how to order product and change your auto ship and things like that. So it still kind of implies like it's business as usual, sort of like the Martin Luther King holiday. They just forgot to switch the phone on. Then Wednesday morning, everything on the website goes down except for the homepage, and the homepage has this very short, to the point statement saying, for all intents and purposes, I'm paraphrasing, but we're out of business. That's what it says. We're done. And everybody gets kind of blindsided by it. Now, in that, I've already talked about this in detail in the alert, but in that notice, they do say that, and I'm quoting here, we are presently paying those entities required to be paid by statute. Okay, that means by law. Those payments will likely consume all remaining resources. Well, by law, you still have to pay your distributors if they're owed it, and December commissions haven't been paid yet. So I'm thinking they probably, what they just said includes distributors, so distributors should get paid eventually. But as of this recording, we're late afternoon here on Wednesday, the 26th, they have not been paid. Okay, now, December commissions, it's a more of a unilevel type plan, and so you give them a one-week delay, which is typical in most comp plans. So by the end of the first week of January, commissions should have been paid. So, you know, another week and a half later, they say we're out of business and they're still owed for December, let alone what they still owe for, you know, part of the part of January that everybody has worked. Well, here's the thing. Here's the commentary I didn't put into the alert because it gets a little bit involved. I was the owner of a network marketing company back when the company that I had all of my success with for about almost 10 years, when they faded away back in 2003, I kind of looked around the industry, didn't really find anything I could get passionate about. I tried the fake it, you'll make it thing years earlier. Didn't work for me. Couldn't pull that off. So I said, you know what? I'm going to put a business plan together, go find some investors, and start my own company, which I did. And had a technology partner and a product partner, ended up suing the product partner, and we settled, and I can't talk about that. But the technology partner, which is the one that really deserved to be sued, which pretty much single-handedly destroyed the company, ended up moving on because their company pretty much went out of business right after that. It's come back since, but went out of business right after that, and deservedly so. But that's another story for another day. The point is, I was there. Okay, I know what it's like in the home office of a company when you can't pay your next commission run. Okay, you're in a position, and all of you distributors out there that are so easily blasting these guys and saying, okay, even if companies just go out of business, how do you not pay your last month's commissions? How do you do that? I mean, how do you go all the way till, you know, the 16th of December or of January before you announce it? And, you know, in other words, how they did it was still wrong. There had to have been some overlap between the time they knew they were going out of business and they were still taking orders and bringing in some money. Okay, first of all, we don't know if any of that's true. And secondly, let me give you a little bit of a perspective from their point of view, from the inside looking out, not from where all of you're at, which is the outside looking in. Because I was there. I was there when I had to look at this company and go, okay, auto ships are triple billing people, if they build at all. We're three pay runs into this thing, and they're still not calculating checks correctly. And this big, great first month we had, it's starting to go down, and you know, we're not, and there's financial problems. The biggest one was that my two partners, which were supposed to be funding the company, came up with a minute fraction of the amount of money they were supposed to come up with. Like a single-digit percentage of it. So, when it came time to run a commission run, and we didn't have the money to do it, guess whose pocket it came out of? That's right, it came out of mine. And it came out of it again, and again, and again, and the number eventually got up to a very, very high, staggering number. A cash investment I wasn't supposed to be presenting, but I did it because the distributors had to be paid, and they had to be paid on time, because here's what happens. Now, again, I'm not patronizing anybody listening to this. I'm assuming that you are a more sophisticated group of distributors because you take the time to listen to me talk about this kind of stuff. But the vast majority of your peers out there, like I said, are a very fickle, flighty bunch of people, and they spook easily. You hear me say that a lot because it's true. When I was in Longevity Network, the company that I had all the success with for all that years, which is now gone, we would have this like a bonus pool where anyone who reached a certain rank during the pay cycle got a part of this 2% bonus pool of all the volume in the company. Every time a share of that bonus pool would go down from like $550 to $495, I get all these calls going, why is sales dropping? Like, no one would ever assume that it's because more people are qualifying for the rank and it's getting split more ways. It has to be because sales are going down. That was the immediate assumption across the board. That's just the way network marketing distributors are. It's as a group. I mean, they're always keenly aware of, you know, what's going on with the company. Is this thing going down? Am I building for nothing? And any little thing is going to spook them. So if your checks are even a day or two late, you can get away with it maybe once if it's legitimately because of a banking error or a technology error that you fixed. You can go to that well maybe one time. But if they're ever late a second time, or they're late for any substantial number of days, or God forbid the checks bounce, you're done. Unconditionally, your business is done, you're gone, close the doors. The same thing as telling distributors, we're struggling a little bit here, your checks are going to be a little bit late, we promise we're going to pay you. Any kind of language, I don't care how you soften that, the slightest hint to the field that you're having financial problems is the exact same thing as what Eero did, putting something up on your homepage saying, we're out of business, shut the doors, lock it, go home. There is no middle ground here. If the field even begins to suspect you're having financial problems, you're dead. It'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy. A great example of this, by the way, would be the old company Nutrition for Life, publicly traded. And, you know, they had a couple of bad quarters for reasons, by the way, had nothing to do with that company. It's another story for another day. But still, a couple of bad quarters where it went down. They had to open up their books and tell everybody, oh, you know, we've contracted a little bit for a couple of quarters. Well, guess what that did? The psychology alone of, oh, a couple of quarters of contraction for an MLM company that's supposed to be geometrically expanding, it caused a third bad quarter. They didn't necessarily quit, but a lot of distributors said, I'm going to hold off and kind of see if this is okay. But as soon as they hold off, well, then it creates another bad quarter. Three bad quarters in a row creates a fourth bad quarter. Well, I think it was like 16 consecutive bad quarters in a row, and the company goes out of business. So one of the drawbacks, by the way, of being a publicly traded company, I always say that when you're in profit and things are going great and you're going into momentum, best thing in the world is to be a publicly traded company because you can prove it with audited financials. But as soon as things turn ugly, you can't wear makeup. You got to reveal that too. And then it could perpetuate the downfall of the company. So it could. I mean, there's examples of companies come out of that because foreign markets expand and the overall company continues to go up. But still, here we have a situation where, I mean, try to think of it from the standpoint of Eero Research Corporate. Okay, it's the end of December. You've just run your commission run, first week of January. You don't have enough money to pay that. Hey, what do you do? Well, do you look for other investors to keep the company going? If you do that, you sure as hell keep it secret. Because the word, by the way, there are no secrets in this industry. It's the world's biggest grapevine. People are always going to find out something sometime or another. But if they find out you're looking for more capital to keep the company going months later, after everything turns around and is great and everybody's getting paid, no big deal. But how do we know they didn't do that? I kind of believe they did. Tried to find some funds someplace from somewhere to shore this thing up. That's what I did. It came out of my pocket, but still, we did it. So let's say that they say, okay, well, we got this new issue of this magazine coming out, and it's the beginning of the new year, coming out of the holidays. Probably sales volume will go up a little bit again. People get reignited. Let's see how the first couple of weeks of the new year goes. See if enough revenue comes in so we can pay off these December commissions, as opposed to just closing the doors when there's no hope of paying them. Now, this is a best-case scenario, and I'm making this up, but how do we know that's not what happened? Why do we always assume the worst-case scenario, these scoundrels just kept the thing going secretly for a couple of weeks just so they could get some more money in their pocket? I don't think they're going to be profiting out of this deal. Okay, they're going to pay off their vendors and their, taxes and everything, and probably not have enough for commissions, unfortunately. I don't think they're going to pocket much of this. So if they stayed open for a couple of weeks to get more sales volume, it was to pay off a few more vendors and a few more taxes and possibly pay off a few more distributors. So again, I don't know. Maybe they did. I'm not a mind reader. But I'm just saying, why not give them the benefit of the doubt? Look at it from their standpoint. There's no way they could have tipped their hand and let anybody know this thing was struggling. So they tried to keep it going. And you don't announce you're out of business until the day you announce you're out of business. That's the only time you can do it. When they were talking to their leaders that Friday before, you don't say, hey guys, we're thinking about going out of business. We might announce that next week, or any language that even remotely suggests that. Because if you do that, then you're out of business because they're all going to leave. So again, cut them some slack here until we really know the facts, if we ever know the facts. And if distributors aren't paid, by the way, there'll probably be a lawsuit. And there'll be disclosures and discovery and all this kind of stuff. And we'll learn some of the facts. But right now, don't always assume the worst. Sometimes a company just goes out of business. All right, guys, that's it for this one. I'm going to try to keep these going, maybe get another one out here in about a week. I want to talk about there's an interesting going-ons here with Melaleuca and their lawsuit. I think that's an intriguing thing for some of you who might want to follow. Of course, we have another resident for our doghouse on the next Inside Network Marketing show. And the company that I'm going to be featuring and doing an analysis of is one called Monetium, the new portfolio program that's just launched recently. And as you can probably tell, I typically don't do infomercials for companies. Like, I'm not going to bring on a company to tell you all the great things about them, because then you'll stop supporting the show and you'll stop telling other people to come on and listen to me because Len pitches other network marketing companies, which really sucks that that's the way the industry goes, but that's the way it is. Again, a lot of you probably wouldn't do that because you're, I think, a more mature, sophisticated group, and I honestly mean that because, again, you listen to the show. You're already in the top 5% right there. And I think a disproportionate number of you probably have enough confidence in your opportunity to not be intimidated or afraid of hearing someone else say nice things about other companies. And that's why I will tend to do that from time to time, even though it's not a company I'm in. But for the most part, if I'm going to do a whole review of a company, you can pretty much assume it's probably not going to be that positive. And that's going to be the case here, too. So, again, look for the next show. Get on the list for the alerts. Subscribe to that so you'll be notified when these shows are coming out. So, again, that's it for this edition of Inside Network Marketing. Thanks for hanging in with me for so long, and we'll see you back here again next time. Have a great week.